Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, this is Ed Fallon, your host, and we're coming to you from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, we got content that's important to you wherever you live in this vast country of ours. Thanks to the dozen or so stations around the U.S. that broadcast this program, and thanks to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. We're going to talk about water, and we've talked about water a lot on this program, but this is a bit of a different angle. All right, so the Great Lakes, five big, beautiful jewels up in the northern part of the country, 21% of the fresh water on Earth is in those lakes. That's incredible. 21% of the entire fresh water supply, it's right there. On the other hand, down in the southwest, the Colorado River is historically low level. Lake Mead last year fell to 27% of its capacity. And between Lake Mead, Lake Powell, and the Colorado River, that's 40 million people who get their water. And it's less and less water all the time. And despite that, there are more and more people moving there. And despite that, we're seeing an expansion of other entities that use water. Agriculture for sure is big, but now we get these data centers. So the Southwest is running out of water. It's not a question of if they run out of water, it's when. Bottom line is the water resources of that part of the country cannot sustain the population that has grown there. They certainly can't sustain the industry and expansions that are planned. You know, and the aquifers are in drastic decline. There is absolutely no way this is not going to be a crisis, and probably sooner rather than later. So meanwhile, back up north here, the Great Lakes states, of which Iowa is not one, by the way. Let me see if I can, there are eight of them. I'll see if I can name them. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. I think I did it. So that whole area, those eight states have come together years ago, back in, I think, 2008, they put together something called the Great Lakes Compact. And it's an agreement that prohibits any large-scale diversion of water from the Great Lakes. Now, of course, Congress or the president could declare a national emergency and override that compact and send that water somewhere else. This hasn't happened, of course. Well, actually, in a small way, these things have happened. And even well before the compact was ever created, this is back in, the early part of the 1900s, the Chicago River, little known fact outside of this area, the Chicago River was reversed. The flow was reversed. Instead of flowing into the Lake Michigan, or as current Governor Pritzker likes to call it, Lake Illinois, It was reversed to flow into the Mississippi River. So to take all that waste from Chicago and put it somewhere else, it's a very questionable decision, but one that now is in effect. Because Chicago is not, it's technically not in the, it's hard to explain, but they're not really in the basin, the Great Lakes Basin. And actually, if you go up north of Lake Superior, you don't have to go very far north of Lake Superior where that water in the boundary waters begins to drain north into the Hudson Bay area. So the watershed is an interesting place. It's not this vast area like the Mississippi River. I mean, the Mississippi River draws water from all over the place. I mean, you know, way up in Montana. So anyway, I'm digressing a bit here, and I apologize because this fascinates me. But there's so Chicago was Chicago did that before the compact, but somewhat related to that, but also related to Chicago's, you know, political and economic might in that 8-state region, there was a loophole that allowed them to sell water to another town outside the watershed, the town of Joliet, Illinois. And then in 2016, another agreement was, another loophole was created when all 8 states agreed to sell water from Lake Michigan to Waukesha, Wisconsin, also outside the watershed. So the people who are going to argue for diverting the Great Lakes water are going to say, hey, you've got these exceptions. You got this reversal of the river in Chicago. You've got Joliet getting water from the lake. You've got Waukesha, Wisconsin. So why not Phoenix, Arizona? You know, why not Las Vegas? Why not Los Angeles? Why not build a pipeline from the Great Lakes down to places that really need this water? And that pressure has been there for a while. It's one reason the 8 states formed this compact. And that pressure is only going to grow. So if that happens, of course, I'll get into that more. If that happens, you can kiss the Great Lakes goodbye. But the other possibility is that, and this one actually makes more sense, that people from the Southwest are going to say, okay, we're out of water, we got to leave, we're going to move to the Great Lakes states. That, of course, creates new problems because, again, the water in the Great Lakes, this is interesting. It's not renewable. This is something I did not know, that 99% of the water in the Great Lakes is what's called fossil water. It was put there by glaciers. Again, we're probably not going to wait for the next glacier to come along and refill them. That's probably not going to happen anytime soon. There is water that flows into the Great Lakes, but it's not a lot. You can't rely on this with a plan for excessive extraction and expect it to last. And if you start pumping that down to the Southwest, you know, I mean, the most instructive example from around the world is the Aral Sea. The Aral Sea is in the Soviet Union. Well, it's former Soviet Union. I think it's in Russia. I'm not sure where it's now that the Soviet Union has dissolved long ago, 1989. But when it was the USSR, the government of the USSR diverted water from the Aral Sea for agricultural use. Now, that was the fourth largest lake in the world. So it was bigger than one of our Great Lakes, or maybe bigger than a couple of them, in fact. It's now 10% of its size. The Aral Sea, 90% of it, is now a desert. So this is the best instruction we have for what might happen to the Great Lakes if we allow the diversion of that water to the Southwest. Or, I mean, and the other option is better but not sustainable, or if we allow such a massive influx of population to those 8 states that the draining of that water continues. You know, right now it's not a problem, but it could become one, you know, especially as you start envisioning all these different types of extraction between agriculture and data centers and whatnot. It's not a sustainable situation at all. Here's another glitch. The Great Lakes are, in part, the U.S.-Canadian border, not entirely, but the border runs right through much of the Great Lakes. So 35% of the Great Lake water is controlled by Canada. So if we have this internal conflict, some are saying it could be a civil war, over what to do, how to manage, how to use, who gets to use that water, it's not just an internal decision because, again, 35% of it, quote, belongs to Canada. This is a really big deal, folks. And I'm surprised at how few people seem to be paying attention to it outside of the Great Lakes area and how little it receives any major conversation politically at the national stage. Anyway, we may talk more about this. I have a feeling it's going to be a bigger issue sooner rather than later. All right, to totally switch gears on you here, folks, I want to talk about the Department of Justice has been branding peaceful protesters as terrorists through certain decisions that are, in my opinion and the opinion of legal scholars, is clearly incompatible with the U.S. Constitution. So I'll give you two examples. In June of last year, there was a group of protesters in Spokane, Washington, who sat in front of a bus. That bus was hauling people who were arrested to a detention center. There was an immigration raid. People accused of being in the U.S. illegally were hauled onto the bus and prepared to be taken to this detention center in, I think, Tacoma. So people blocked the road. 9 protesters were arrested. 6 went with the plea bargain option. 3 decided to take their case to trial, and they were charged with conspiracy, which is ridiculous. I mean, they were blocking a bus. I've never done that, but I've done things that under the current administration might be considered conspiratorial. It's just because the definition is so broad now. They were charged with conspiracy to impede or injure officers. I don't even quite understand how that whole charge comes together. But right now, the defendants are facing up to 6 years in federal prison and $250,000 each in fines. So Washington's, the ACLU legal director out there, LaRonda Baker, said, and I quote, "The ACLU is concerned about the chilling effect that the Department of Justice's charging decisions will have on protest and free expression in this country." She went on to say, "The administration has a demonstrable history of using the Department of Justice to silence and punish its critics. Using the power of government to deter criticism is undemocratic and counter to the values of our state and our country." Adding to that, the mayor of Spokane, Lisa Brown, said, quote, "This prosecution was politically motivated. It was meant to make an example out of people who disagreed with federal immigration policy. The right to peacefully protest and criticize the government is a cornerstone of our democracy," end quote. Yeah, so sure. I mean, block a bus, get arrested for trespassing. But conspiracy? Come on. The other example I want to share with you is from The Intercept. So back in March, a couple months ago, the federal agents raided the home of 2 people who were allegedly members of Antifa. That was in Alvarado, Texas. I don't know how. Anyway, there are 9 defendants now who are on trial for their involvement with a demonstration outside the Prairie Land Detention Center in Alvarado. That's an ICE facility. I'm very concerned about this too. It ended with a local police officer being shot, who was wounded by gunfire. And, okay, that's bad, right? I have nothing but criticism of that. But then the whole prosecution, the case got out of hand. I mean, the DOJ has now charged 8 of those 9 defendants with terrorism, and partly because they wore black clothing at the protest. So defense attorneys argued a couple of weeks ago that prosecutors had overcharged this case, should have centered on the alleged shooter instead of the larger group. And I totally agree. I mean, I think most responsible people would agree that shooter needs to be held accountable. To be clear, I am no fan of Antifa's tactics. Again, the group stands for anti-fascist. I like that. I don't like their tactics. I have my own run-in with Antifa people back during the Occupy Wall Street movement. I helped organize a march here in Des Moines, and they kind of took it over. they wore masks. They yelled vulgar messages. They carried a desecrated American flag. I said, hey, this is not the best message. I mean, there's TV cameras there. This is what you want to do, you know? And they started yelling at me, calling me Officer Fallon, implying that I was somehow associated with police. I don't have a lot of love for the organization or its tactics. I will say this. I think some of the tactics are pretty good. And some of what they do is pretty good. Here's a definition. Antifa is a decentralized movement of loosely affiliated autonomous groups who actively oppose fascism, white supremacy, and far-right extremism. Antifa, quote, members use direct action, mostly nonviolent action, like mutual aid and tracking far-right groups, some adherents also participated in physical clashes and property damage. Honestly, I'm okay with most of that. I don't like the physical clashes and property damage part. But I certainly support opposing fascism. I certainly support nonviolent direct action. And mutual aid, yeah, we probably need more and more of that. So I'm fine with all that. My own personal interaction with Antifa has not been great. But they have a right to say what they want to say. They have a right, even though I didn't like what they did at the rally that I or the march that I helped organize, yeah, they had a right to. They had a right to wear masks, a right to say vulgar things, a right to carry an up, you know, a desecrated American flag. I don't like any of that. That doesn't mean it's not something that's protected by our First Amendment. So again, right now the DOJ is really going hard at assaulting our First Amendment, and we have to push back against that. Hey, I got to take a short break, folks. When we come back, more conversation. We're going to start off by talking about self-driving trucks. Back in a minute with you on the Fallon Forum with a reminder that underwriting for this program is provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks, broadcasting from Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. Hey, before we talk about a big national issue involving trucks, I want to talk a little bit about Iowa. Anytime Iowa makes the New York Times, anytime whatever, you know, rural community, small state you're from makes the New York Times, it's kind of a big thing, right? So Iowa made the New York Times. We were one of six states that had primaries back on June 2nd. First of all, the New York Times talks about what happened in the Republican primary for governor in Iowa. Because it was a surprise to a lot of people. You know, President Trump endorses the candidate, boom, that candidate's in, right? You know, it just happens all the time, right? Even if that candidate is running against a longtime serving incumbent, like Bill Cassidy down in Louisiana, Thomas Massie in Kentucky, John Cornyn in Texas, all three incumbents beaten by outsiders endorsed by Donald Trump. So the New York Times writes, but the president's remarkable winning streak came to a screeching halt in Iowa, where Republican primary voters rejected his choice in the governor's race, U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, and nominated a first-time candidate named Zach Lahn instead. All right, that's what the New York Times had to say about that. Part of this might be, a big part of it might be, that Trump didn't endorse Feenstra until like 4 days before the election. I mean, bottom line is, a lot of people had already voted by then. Feenstra is only well known in one-fourth of Iowa. He's been painted as an insider. That's not a good thing to be these days on either party. He made a big mistake, in my opinion, by skipping debates. There were those in the race that came off as stronger potential Trump allies than Feenster: Brad Sherman, Adam Steen, Zach Lahn. What distinguished Lahn from Feenster was he had money and momentum. And Trump probably knew that. His handlers probably knew. He probably felt he had to endorse Feenster, but it was a very lukewarm endorsement. Mostly lukewarm because he waited until the last minute. That hasn't happened before. The evangelical movement in Iowa is very, very strong within the Republican Party. And so they had candidates to choose from. And Steen was very popular among the evangelical base. So was Lahn. But there was one influential talking head, Stephen Dace, who I know personally, been on his program before. It's not a fun experience. toward the end, he switched his support from Steen to Lahn when it became clear that Lahn had the momentum. And why did Lahn have the momentum? More than anything, it was about money. Lahn is wealthy. He loaned his campaign $2 million. That allowed him to stay competitive with Feenster. And Steen wasn't even close. I think Steen was just barely over $500,000, which is a lot of money for normal people, but not a lot of money for a campaign for governor. So the extreme elements of the Republican base went with Lahn, and that was enough to tank Feenster. I think Trump's enthusiasm about Feenster was totally lukewarm. I think he's going to be very, very happy with somebody as extreme as Lahn. And we're going to talk more about Lahn next week. You know, the New York Times goes on to talk about the Senate primary and says, quote, "Iowa is still a very tough state for Democrats, especially in federal elections. But as the state struggles under Trump's economic policies, Iowa may become more competitive this year." End of quote. Yeah, duh. Okay, obviously. It's Iowa's going to be very competitive this year. And there are other places in the country, too, that have tended to lean Republican that are going to be much more competitive, despite what's going on with redistricting. All right, I'm going to switch gears and talk about trucks. Specifically, self-driving trucks. All right, interesting story in The Lever a couple weeks ago, talking about how the autonomous truck driving industry has been heavily lobbying U.S. House members and the Senate as well, of course. But they convinced the U.S. House to insert a provision into a transportation funding bill. I want to say that bill was like over 1,000 pages. It was a huge one. The language would block individual states from setting up any kind of a safety standard for self-driving trucks or buses or other commercial vehicles, you know, despite calls for tougher standards. So yeah, here it is again, folks, the federal government preempting local authority. And, you know, so I want to say, where are all the defenders of the 10th Amendment? You mean the 10th Amendment? And I'll quote it for you. "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." Now, maybe some people have forgotten, but Republicans over the years, and especially Tea Party Republicans, and to some extent MAGA voters, have for years talked about getting the federal government out of local business. So if it's a matter that the state is kind of indicated the state should deal with by the U.S. Constitution, or cities or counties, the federal government needs to stay out of those. You know, we hear about that all the time, until it becomes inconvenient. And, you know, until you've got somebody like Trump in charge, and suddenly the 10th Amendment doesn't matter that much. And to whatever extent the federal government can take over and, you know, overrule state authority, the better. So this was a big wet kiss to the autonomous vehicle industry. Again, overriding state autonomous commercial vehicle regulations, installing a national framework. And they're going to argue that, oh, we put a national framework in place. But it allows pretty much unrestricted expansion of self-driving trucks across the U.S. Now, again, this is not a black and white issue, because, you know, one argument is that truck traffic crosses state boundaries. So, yeah, maybe there needs to be a broader national perspective on how we regulate autonomous trucks. The other thing is, too, that this is compelling. This is a compelling argument for the autonomous truck industry. So far, there have been zero fatalities due to autonomous trucks. That's an impressive record. I mean, again, it's a record built on very minimal data so far. And during the same time, there's been a 30% increase in large truck fatalities driven by humans over the past, 10 years. Again, we're talking about a much bigger universe there than the tiny universe of autonomous truck driving. You know, so I get it from a safety perspective and maybe an interstate commerce perspective. I get why this proposal makes some sense. But again, it's too early. It's too broad a stroke. You know, why not trust states to figure out what works best for them? You know, it's what our Constitution would allow, and it's what's beginning to happen. So there's a group called the Truck Safety Coalition. It's an advocacy group of trucking accident victims and survivors. And they say the proposal, the federal proposal, sacrifices, quote, common sense safety measures to satisfy industry interests. So the Truck Safety Coalition doesn't like it. And meanwhile, dozens of states, so probably where this is coming from, why the autonomous truck industry, again, maybe we just call it the big truck tech industry, because this is another aspect of AI, right? They see the writing on the wall. They see that states are beginning to take action, and they want to make sure that states don't get too far. So they put in a fairly minimal set of regulations at the federal level. Because there are, again, dozens of states working on stuff. New York and Massachusetts, for example, they have fairly rigorous safety and reporting requirements. And, you know, other state legislation is in the works. Legislation that would require human operators to be present in every autonomous vehicle. So, you know, where this goes, I don't know. Again, I do think I try to look at it fairly. There are legitimate concerns about safety and about interstate commerce. But this is clearly an effort by one industry to preempt local authority on an issue that, you know, according to the U.S. Constitution, probably ought to rest with the states. Hey, I got to take a short break, folks. Back in a minute, and a reminder that underwriting for the Fallon Forum is provided by Westrum Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055.
Number 5.
Due process, the right to a fair trial. You can't be charged twice for the exact same crime. You can plead the fifth to not self-incriminate, and your life, liberty, and property is something they just can't take.
Number 6.
The accused has the right to a speedy trial. By an impartial jury, provide a lawyer on their side.
Number 7.
In civil legal matters involving more than $20, a trial by jury is what this amendment honors.
Number 8.
Grip is cruel and unusual punishment, protecting from unreasonable fines or awful sentences.
Number 9.
Recognizes the Constitution might be missing rights that aren't written down, but citizens still are given.
Number 10.
What about powers that are not written down? Does the federal government push the state governments around? The fear of federalism by the anti-federalists, worried about creating another tyrannical government. Make sure the Bill of Rights had a 10th Amendment to ensure powers not written down went to the state government.
The Bill of Rights.
Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers. Formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry, Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrum Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrum and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrum's primary concern. Dr. Westrum and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks for joining us today, folks. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, underwriting for this program provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More information at architecturebysynthesis.com. So I came across a good article recently called How to Survive the Rest of Trump's Regime. It's by Ashla Aydintashbash. I hope I'm saying her name right. It's Turkish. And it was written before Trump's second term began, but it's still very relevant. I want to share it with you. Ashla was a journalist in Turkey during the rise of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the authoritarian ruler. And she writes, quote, "For over a decade, I covered Turkey's descent into illiberalism. I know how self-censorship starts in small ways, but then creeps into operations on a daily basis. I am familiar with the rhythms of the battle to reshape the media, state institutions, and the judiciary. Having lived through it and having gathered some lessons in hindsight, I believe that there are strategies that can help Democrats and Trump critics not only survive the coming 4 years, but come out stronger. Here are six of them." Okay, and I think it's some of the points I don't really agree with that much. First one is don't panic. I think actually it's about time to panic a bit. She claims that autocracy takes time. Yes, it does take time. She says that it took Erdogan over a decade to fully consolidate his power in Turkey. Hungary's Viktor Orban and Poland's Law and Justice Party needed years to erode democratic norms and fortify their grip on state institutions. Okay, fair enough, I noted, but it took Adolf Hitler 18 months, okay? So I don't think we should panic and run around like chickens with our heads cut off, but I do think we should be in panic mode. Disagree with that. Okay, she does point out, this is a good point too, the U.S. is America's decentralized system of governance. The network of state and local governments offers enormous resilience. Federal judges serve lifetime appointments. States and governors have specific powers separate from those granted federally. There are local legislatures, and the media has the First Amendment as a shield, reinforced by over a century of legal precedents. Okay, all good points, but as we talked about earlier, both the First and the Tenth Amendments are being throttled by the current administration. And when it comes to local control, I mean, we do have a good, you know, division of power within this country, but that's being run over. And the example I gave earlier about trucks, this is one of hundreds of examples you can give about how the federal government is preempting local authority. And we're seeing that too here at the state level, for example, in Iowa, how the state government is preempting local authority. The most egregious example here in Iowa is how the legislature passed a property tax bill that basically eviscerates local government's budgets at a time when they just simply can't afford to have that kind of a hit. So, yeah, local governments are still, I think, where the strongest resistance to tyranny lies, and also the most accountability to local to the citizenry lies. But they're under a lot of crunch from, in some cases, state governments, and certainly across the board from the federal government. Her second point, don't disengage, stay connected. Okay, totally agree. She says, quote, "The answer to political defeat is not to disconnect, but to organize. You can take a couple of days or weeks off, commiserate with friends, and mute Elon Musk on X, or erase the app altogether. But in the end, the best way to develop emotional resilience is greater engagement." Her third point is don't fear the infighting. And she says, quote, "Trump has tapped into the widespread belief that the economic order and the immigration system are broken. For the Democratic Party to redefine itself as a force for change and not just as the custodian of the status quo, it needs fundamental shifts in how it relates to working people in the U.S. Boom, spot on. I mean, don't fear infighting, because it's been going on for a long time. I mean, I've been arguing since the 90s with the Democratic Party, and I've gotten into trouble since the 90s with the folks that run the Democratic Party. And I can go on for a long time about what that means. I was thrown out of my position as the ranking member on the House Local Government Committee. I was voted to be the elected official you most like to publicly flog. I responded to that with a public flogging. That was a lot of fun. even though I had this great voting record on labor stuff, and my pro-choice voting record was 100%, you know, I still, because I was challenging the party on a lot of priorities, I got booted from everything, you know. So I know how that works. We shouldn't fear infighting, and we should continue to challenge the status quo within the Democratic Party and beyond. It's not just a partisan issue in this country. It's a broader issue. Okay, fourth, she says, charismatic leadership is a non-negotiable. She says, one lesson from Turkey and Hungary is clear. You will lose if you don't find a captivating leader, as was the case in 2023 general election in Turkey and 2022 in Hungary. Coalition building or economic messaging is necessary and good, but not enough. You need charisma to mobilize social dissent. I don't agree with that. And maybe I think it's good to have lots of leaders, lots of charisma, but to have one point person who becomes the savior that you all revolve around, that's the stuff the movies are made of. That's Neo in The Matrix, or Kevin Costner in any movie that Kevin Costner's in. Maybe it works in Turkey or Poland, but I don't think it's the way things tend to go here or should go here. And I know the media likes to say, well, so-and-so, like Martin Luther King, made the civil rights movement happen. No doubt Martin Luther King was very, very important to the civil rights movement. But there were a lot of other people who were involved with that. And the media tend to want to like undervalue their contributions so they can focus on someone. It makes for an easier story. But it's not true. I don't know whether it was true in Turkey or Poland, but it certainly hasn't been true here historically. And I don't think it's going to be true at this time and place either. So she says, quote, skip the protest and identity politics. For the longest time in Turkey, the opposition made the mistake of relying too much on holding street demonstrations and promoting secularism, defined Turkey's version of identity politics, which speaks to the urban, professional, and middle class, but not beyond. When Erdogan finally lost his absolute predominance in Turkish politics in 2024, it was largely because of his mismanagement of the economy and the opposition's growing competence in that area. Well, I couldn't agree with that more. I don't think we should skip street protests, but I think we need to put them in perspective. They're good organizing moments. And if they're just moments where you come together and wave some flags and signs and go home, that's a wasted opportunity. But if organizers use those street protests as a way to organize the next level, and a lot of that has to do with political participation. It has to do with being willing to talk to people who might think differently or vote differently than we do and try to find those areas of common ground and build on that. You know, so she's right to an extent, I think, that if we just focus on street protests, we're making a mistake. And certainly if we focus on identity politics, I mean, some of my closest friends and collaborators who are against identity politics are not white and male. I mean, the bottom line is it's important that everybody be treated with equality, fairness, and justice. But to continue to kind of make that the highest priority, yeah, it's going to alienate. It's going to be very appealing to certain urban, professional, and middle-class people, but it's not going to work beyond that. And I think that's a very timely critique of the Democratic Party. Her sixth point is have hope. Okay, who can't agree with that, right? Nothing lasts forever, she says, and the U.S. is not the only part of the world that faces threats to democracy. And Americans are no different than the French, the Turks, or Hungarians when it comes to the appeal of the far right. But in a country with a strong, decentralized system of government, with a long-standing tradition of free speech, the rule of law should be far more resilient than anywhere in the world. I'll just finish up with what she says. Trump's return to power certainly poses challenges to U.S. democracy, but he will make mistakes and overplay his hand at home and abroad. America will survive the next 4 years if Democrats and other Trump critics pick themselves up and start learning from the successes of opponents of autocracy across the globe. End of quote. And yeah, I totally agree with that. And again, this was written in January of 2025, prior to Trump had won, but he had yet to have his inauguration. But yeah, overplay his hand. Oh gosh, is he ever? I mean, domestically and overseas. You know, I was talking with someone just a couple days ago, someone who works a blue-collar job, and I asked him how his staff felt about the, you know, about the Trump administration. He said, well, you know, yeah, some of the younger guys had voted for Trump, but for one reason or another, they're starting to have serious buyer's regret. And there is a lot of buyer's regret out there right now. And she's exactly right about that. You got to have hope. There are threats beyond the threat to our democracy that concern me even more. I mean, I'm very concerned about where this country is heading, not necessarily just under Donald Trump, but beyond that. But I'm also very concerned about the threat of nuclear war, the threat of climate change, the threat of AI becoming an existential, you know, challenge. We got a lot on our hands, and I understand how it can be easy to become hopeless. But certainly when it comes to defending democracy, I think we've got a good chance of seeing a pushback, a retracting away from the slide into autocracy. And under a democratic globe, ideally, this is not just a U.S. issue, but around the globe, we see a return to democracy, embracing the appropriate use of the word liberal. I don't, you know, I use that in terms of acceptance, of broad-mindedness, of openness, of freedom. That's what liberal means to me. You know, if we can see the world returning to that perspective, that democratic perspective, then those other challenges I just mentioned become, you know, you begin to see hope in how they can be addressed. Okay, I'll switch gears, and here's an example of where Trump may be losing some supporters. Again, I wish this would get more conversation, and I wish there would be some additional research into what's really going on with these boat strikes in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean. Trump's military have hit more than 60 boats. They've killed at least 200 people. And they argue that, well, we're at war, we're battling the drug cartels. And yet there's no evidence that there's drugs on these boats. They're blowing them up. I mean, this has been going on for what, 9 months now? Who knows? I mean, that's the bottom line, is maybe they are all smuggling drugs. But you know what? If they were, you would think the Trump administration would, instead of blowing them up, would board them. No question they have the power to do that. They could overwhelm these boats easily. They're what, tiny speed boats, fishing boats? There's no doubt that we have the power, if we wanted to stop them, board them, see what's on board. And if we did, and if we found drugs, then boom, we could say, okay, yeah, well, we did this. But no, instead of doing that, they're just blowing them up without having any idea what's really being transported, without any accountability. Killing people, they may just be civilians. Maybe some are criminals. Maybe some are trafficking drugs. Maybe some of them are just fishermen. There's no way of knowing, because they are blowing up the evidence. Bottom line is, if they really wanted to be on the side of truth on this, they wouldn't do it that way. So my theory is that they're doing this to send a message. And it's a message consistent with what they've said before about the U.S. is back in charge of the Western Hemisphere now. We've reclaimed our right to control the Western Hemisphere, all the way from the Arctic down to Tierra del Fuego. And we've shown that by threatening Canada. In retrospect, that's not happening. We said we'd make them our 51st state. And again, mark my words on this, is going to be a battle with Canada over water in the Great Lakes. And, you know, of course, Mexico, Trump threatening to just go into Mexico and try to fix the problems there. What happened in Venezuela, removing the leader we don't want and replacing him with his vice president. You know, clearly not regime change, just putting a more friendly person to big oil in charge, and now threatening Cuba. You know, it's clear that the Trump administration is sending a message that, yeah, we're in control of this hemisphere now. And one way you know that is because we just blow up these boats whenever we want. Yeah, we have an excuse as to what's going on, but we don't need to justify ourselves, even though it is clearly a violation of international law. So, Eric Schmidt, a guy who covers national security, said Honduras may also be next in line to, quote, normalize an American military presence across Latin America. And of course, Trump, as I said, has also said he wants boots on the ground in Mexico. Stephen Miller, who I think is kind of the man behind the curtain here, he has this bi-monthly meeting, apparently, where he has these, he talks about the wins of the government, the way they've won. The Pentagon's death toll from both strikes is considered a win. Again, regardless of evidence, regardless of details, regardless of the options that they have to actually figure out who they're killing. So we'll see what happens with that. I want to end with something I'm really happy about. Makes me want to go to Charlotte, North Carolina. There's a restaurant there called The Antagonist, which is a great name for a restaurant. It's a cocktail and coffee bar. And it requires customers to place their phones in a lockable pouch during their time there. So you're not allowed to take your phone into the restaurant. You lock it up. If you, for some reason, need your phone at any time while you're there, you come back out, they take the phone out, you make your call. And you would think, oh yeah, people are gonna say, I'm not gonna let them take my phone away. No, I'm not gonna go to that place. But apparently, it's going really well for them. The owner says, quote, to be honest with you, most people are excited to give us their phones, which I think is great. There was an NPR story about this where they talk about people sitting at tables, talking or playing board games provided by the bar. Some are chatting up the bartenders. You know, in recent years, apparently, it's not just The Antagonist. No phone bars and restaurants have also opened in New York and Washington, D.C. Not here in Des Moines yet. We'll see. So there's a psychiatrist quoted in this story from Stanford University. She's Anna Lemke, daughter of Dopamine Nation. She says, phones have become an easy escape, especially in social settings. Whenever there's an awkward social moment, people just pull out their phones and pretend to be absorbed by something. Or maybe they are absorbed by something. So ignoring that impulse is hard, but it's easier when everyone in the room is doing the same. So one patron at The Antagonist said, I'm enjoying the moment. I'm having conversations. I'm making eye contact. I'm not worrying about a text or checking Instagram. Another patron said, honestly, it's fantastic. Life needs to be more like this. So, before guests go, staff take their photo. This is nice, right? When you're done with your hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, of no phone time in the restaurant, on your way out, they give you your phone back, and then they take your photo with a Polaroid camera. And they give you this small little memory from your time at The Antagonist. I think that's pretty cool. Anyway, back in a minute, folks. Underwriting for this program provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Klipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Farm. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Well, Kathy, welcome to the program. And you've been doing some research on the International Year of the Woman Farmer.
I never knew it was until just chanced upon that in something else I was looking at. It seems that in 2024, the United Nations put their heads together, and USDA sent a delegate, and people from all over the world were there and decided that it was important to call attention to the roles of women in agriculture, especially in the food production aspects of agriculture.
Right, because not all agriculture is food production.
It's true.
Says the guy from Iowa, where over half of our corn crop goes into fuel tanks. Anyway.
Well, so in 2024, they declared that 2026 would be the International Year of the Woman Farmer, which gave them time to, you know, talk about some ways to promote it and call attention. One of the reasons the USDA pointed out back in 2024 that this was important, and I'm going to quote, "Women are responsible for roughly half of the world's food production, and in many countries they produce between 60 and 80% of the food. Yet, globally, the prevalence of food insecurity is higher among women than men." That was just one of the reasons that this was considered a very important thing to do.
Yeah. And so, yeah, now it's 2026, and how's it going? Is it having an impact?
The celebration just started this year, so I hope that there will be some impact. I do want to just note really quickly, when I look at perspective of back in my grandmother's day, and she was a young girl who grew up on a very productive and successful farm in southwest Iowa, she and one of my great aunts, her sister, did some writing years ago about life on the farm. And it drives home a little bit about how much work women have always done on the farms, yet not been called the farmers. So really quickly, from my Aunt Margaret's writing, she said that the routine was up in the morning, eat breakfast, milk cows, feed and water chickens, etc. After school, brought cows from pasture, milked them, fed and watered chickens, gathered eggs, carried in coal, cobs, and wood for stoves, and more. And then my grandmother wrote in her description of life on the farm, and this made me laugh, "The women were kept busy raising ducks, turkey, guineas, and over 1,000 chickens were raised each year. The ducks and geese feathers were used to make pillows and feather beds." The fact that she said the women were kept busy meant that it was considered back then to be a trivial contribution to the farm. The men were the farmers and the women were the homemakers, and they did this and that also.
Well, and I think of my time in Ireland as a kid, which was probably a lot like your great-grandparents' time in southwest Iowa. I mean,
grandmother's time.
But Ireland in the 60s, 70s, and even pushing into the 80s was very much like the U.S. back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Women were responsible for all the cooking and cleaning. But they were also, like my next door neighbor, Maura Sampi, she would milk cows. You know, so, I mean, they had seven kids, so some of the boys would milk cows, but, you know, she was very much responsible for making sure it got into the urn and into the creek where it kept cool till the milk truck came by to
you
pick
bet.
It up. And also when it came to planting the garden, I mean, a huge garden, it wasn't just men doing that. Women were doing that too. So, yeah, I mean, but the same thing, I think. Men tended to get the credit.
It's true.
In Ireland or southwest Iowa.
Well, even when my family moved to the country when I was 14 and Mom started getting a magazine called Farmer's Wife Magazine. We weren't farmers, but she wanted to be in the know about what the other gals around the area were doing, and she made a lot of friends, but they were called farmers' wives. So you mentioned Ireland, and this is cool because you and I just watched most of a documentary last night about women farmers, and this documentary was put together sort of in honor of International Year of the Woman Farmer, but there was in particular a woman from County Clare, and she and her brother run a mixed farm. But she was recently featured in this documentary. She was also named Ireland's Department of Agriculture's Woman Farmer Ambassador of the Year, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Might make you wonder what we're doing in the United States to acknowledge it.
Yeah, what are we doing in the United States?
In individual states, officials are acknowledging Year of the Woman Farmer. So in addition to federal recognition and around the country recognition from heads of state, just noting that the Trump administration earlier this year, well, the Trump administration has not made any official statement, and Trump administration earlier this year refused to accept the nomination of five farmers in the United States or the United Soybean Board. Four of those were women farmers. So yeah. They were nominated, and he refused to accept four women to that board.
So tell the women farmers in your life that you appreciate what they do.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot going on and a lot of progress that still needs to be made. Hey, Kathy, thanks for joining us today. And thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and Real Estate Agent Joe Henry. Also by Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, your host of the Fallon Forum. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.